You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Kick-Ass Politics is brought to you by Fiverr. You've heard me rave about Fiverr before. Fiverr is the world's largest online marketplace for services with over 100,000 categories all offered for a fixed base price of just $5. Logo design, business consulting, marketing, business cards, stationery, web design, translation, transcription, proofreading, legal consulting, and just about any other service you can imagine, all offered at a base price of just $5. And right now, when you go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the Fiverr ad on our sponsor page, you'll be showing our sponsor that you support the show, and you'll get some great offers on services tailored to your needs. Whatever you need done, find it on Fiverr. This week, I'm paying tribute to the founding father of America, with a few episodes exploring the real man behind the myths and the marble busts. When most Americans think of George Washington, we think of the military general who defeated the British against all odds, the man who set the standard for what a U.S. president should be, or the founding father of America who may or may not have been too honest to lie about chopping down a cherry tree. But very rarely do you hear the words George Washington and politician uttered in the same breath. That's because in the popular imagination, we like to think of Washington as being above it all. The man who professed an outright contempt for political parties and partisan politics. The man who more often than not remained silent and dignified amid the squabbling and debate of the other founding fathers. The man who was so loved by Americans that he could have been anointed king. But he chose to serve only 2 terms as president and then quietly retired to his farm in Virginia. And yes, he was all of those things. But Washington didn't stumble into the highest office in the land, and it certainly wasn't happenstance when the Continental Congress appointed Washington commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. In actuality, George Washington was a master of perhaps the hardest political skill of all: being a politician without looking like a politician. He wasn't brazen, he didn't pander, he didn't get down in the muck and engage his rivals, but his subtle knack for showmanship, his sense of timing, his use of symbolism and gesture, and even his frequent use of silence belie a political genius. Today we'll dig deeper into this side of Washington with John Ferling. He's a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia and possibly the foremost scholar on the American Revolution, having written no less than a dozen books on the subject, including The First of Men, A Life of George Washington, and The Ascent of George Washington, The Hidden Political Genius of an American Icon. In just a moment, he'll talk about some of the qualities that made our first president one of the greatest politicians in American history. Stay tuned.
Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
My guest today is John Ferling. He's a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia and a leading scholar on the American Revolution. He's authored 12 books, including The First of Men, A Life of George Washington, and The Ascent of George Washington, The Hidden Political Genius of an American Icon. I wanted to talk to you about the side of George Washington that a lot of people don't know. I tend to think that he suffers from marble bust syndrome, much like Lincoln did until the Spielberg movie came out. It's very hard to really flesh him out as a person and as a politician, but he really was a remarkable politician. I mean, he's the only president who was ever elected by every state in the Electoral College in the history of America. And he wasn't just popular. He was also very much respected. Even Jefferson, who disagreed with him a lot, once said, "All men err, but at least when Washington errs, he errs with integrity." So I'm curious, you did an entire book on his political ascent and his political savvy. George Washington wasn't particularly well educated. He didn't come necessarily from privilege or from great wealth or a political family. Where did he pick up this interest in politics?
I think the driving force behind Washington was his ambition. He, from the time he was young, I think he wanted to be somebody. He grew up, as you said, not in a privileged background, and in fact, he actually inherited very little. When his father died, George was only about 12 years old when his father died, and so it appeared as though he did not have a very bright future. He might be somebody who would be well known in the county that he lived in around Fredericksburg, Virginia, but probably wouldn't be known outside of that, because he wasn't educated and didn't have the means to obtain an education, as you said. And so I think Washington realized from the beginning that the fastest way that he could ascend was by becoming a soldier and perhaps winning recognition as a soldier. And so as a young man, fortunately for him, a war broke out, what we call the French and Indian War, or sometimes the Seven Years' War, and he became a soldier for Virginia. In fact, he commanded what was called the Virginia Regiment, an army that Virginia raised in that war, and he served for almost 5 years as the commander of that military force from the time he was about 22 until he was 27. And that's where he really begins to learn politics, because he has to deal especially with the governor of Virginia. And he didn't do a very good job of it, actually. He eventually, the governor got turned off toward Washington and told Washington that he was an ingrate for, despite everything the governor had done for him, Washington hadn't reciprocated and honored the governor. So I think he learns a lot about how to deal with politicians and with the assemblymen and whatever while he is a military figure during that war. And that's really the beginning, I think, of Washington's learning as a politician. And at the very end of the war, he succeeded in getting elected to the Virginia House of Burgesses, which was the colonial legislature, colonial assembly in Virginia. And he spends about 17 years as a legislator. So he's with politicians, and he's learning more about politicians and learning how legislatures work. But then that war came to an end. He married. He became a plantation owner. He inherits Mount Vernon when Lawrence, that stepbrother that I mentioned, died of tuberculosis. And it looked like George had no political future other than as a legislator in Virginia. And then the Revolutionary War came along, and things began to change in the wake of that.
Right. So what was that transition like for him, going from a military man to the House of Burgesses?
Well, he wasn't a very influential legislator. He was, I guess, what we would call a backbencher. Most of the legislators were lawyers, or a great many were the leaders in the Burgesses were lawyers. And Washington wasn't a lawyer, wasn't well educated, as you mentioned earlier. And I think he felt like a fish out of water in that environment. And in fact, Jefferson and John Adams both said the same thing about Washington. They said it independently of one another, and I think neither was aware that the other had said it. that both described Washington as being very slow and deliberate in making up his mind. But when he did make up his mind, he was usually correct in the decision that he made. But in the legislature, where you have debates going on and give and take, you don't have the luxury of taking your time to think things through. And Washington just couldn't do that. So he never really served on a major committee in the assembly. He was just there. He looked after his interest primarily, didn't sponsor any particularly important legislation. But it was I think, something that he saw as an honor to be in the legislature, and something that a distinguished person would want for himself. And it was a means of getting ahead. Obviously, people in the legislature knew him, and then when the war came along, or when the revolution came along and they selected representatives to the Continental Congress, even though Washington hadn't been a particularly distinguished assemblyman, he was selected as one of the seven delegates that Virginia sent to the First Continental Congress. More, I think, because they probably recognized that war was inevitable. Here was a guy who had 5 years of military experience in commanding the Army of Virginia, and they hoped that if war did come and an army was created, George Washington would be the person that Congress turned to command the army, which of course is exactly what happened.
Right. He certainly had a way of somehow always being in the right place at the right time. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back to talk more with John Ferling about the political ascent of George Washington. Stay tuned. Hi, folks. Do you ever go wine tasting somewhere, say in Napa or somewhere like that, and you run across these great little wines, and you think to yourself, how come I never see these in the grocery store? And you wonder, where can you get these? Well, check out our sponsor, Gold Medal Wine Club. Since 1992, they've been America's leading independent wine club. Unlike other wine clubs, Gold Medal Wines features the really unique and hard-to-find boutique wineries. And virtually every wine they sell meets their strict selection criteria that includes multiple medals from major wine competitions and high ratings from Wine Spectator, Wine Enthusiast, and other national wine publications. And right now, if you go to the show site at kickasspolitics.com and click on our special link on the sponsor page, Gold Medal Wine Club will give you up to 45% off wines rated 90 points and up. Plus, they'll even throw in free shipping. For all your wine desires, Gold Medal Wine Club. And if you like what we're doing here at Kickass Politics and you want to help keep us on the air, then please show your support for the show and make a donation by going to our GoFundMe campaign at GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Your support will help keep us producing new and even more interesting programs in the future. That's GoFundMe.com/kickasspolitics. I appreciate your encouragement and support. Now, enjoy the rest of the show. We're back, and I'm talking with John Ferling about the political genius of George Washington. And it's interesting because we both describe him as a political genius, but there's a sense that in his own time, perhaps Washington was, I guess to borrow a phrase from the other George W., misunderestimated. With Washington, he wasn't one of those guys who was always engaged in heated political debate. And I think there was kind of this mistake of perhaps of people sometimes seeing him as not being a great intellectual or a great political thinker like a Jefferson, an Adams, or a Franklin. But there is a sense, I think, when you look deeper, that in many ways, he was one step ahead of everyone else. Because when you talk about the Continental Congress, there's a story of how he shows up in his military uniform.
Right. At the second Congress, which convened about 3 weeks after the war began, he did bring his uniform along and he wore his uniform. And I think to us in the 21st century, it seems somewhat strange, but apparently it didn't really seem that strange to anybody at the time. The feeling was that even though an army hadn't been created, the colonies were at war, they were going to create an army, and Washington was demonstrating his commitment to the cause by wearing that uniform. So, but I think pretty clearly, too, most historians feel that what Washington was doing subtly or maybe not so subtly was telling them, look, I'm available when you do create the army, and I hope that you'll give me a high position in the army. And I'm sure what he hoped for was to be commander of that army. So in a way, I mean, it was a political move on Washington's part, but a move of some subtlety, not a great deal of subtlety.
Well, there was that side of him that I don't think people realize today, that he was a bit of a showman. And he was very much aware of the power of symbolism.
That's right, yeah. In fact, you know, he John Adams called him the great thespian of his day. He really was, I think, somebody. He loved the theater. When he would go to Williamsburg for the assembly sessions, he would attend the theater while he was commander-in-chief of the Continental Army during the winter months when they weren't campaigning, and even at Valley Forge, he would have the officers perform plays, and he would attend those plays. He never performed in them himself, but he did love the theater. And I think probably the most famous bit of Washington's theatrics came late in the war when there was something of a rebellion among the officers in Newburgh, New York, in early 1783, and Washington was trying to head off that rebellion, and he did it by making a speech to the officers, and the speech pretty much fell flat, and Washington decided something else had to be done, and so he said, I want to read you a letter, and he reached very slowly into his pocket, and he pulled out a letter, which was from a congressman in Virginia. And the letter really didn't amount to much of anything, but Washington started to read that letter, and he stumbled through the first sentence or two, and then he said, again, he stopped and he reached into his pocket very slowly and he pulled out a pair of glasses. And no one had ever seen Washington wear glasses before. I mean, here's this big, strong, hardy individual, and Washington puts on a pair of glasses and he says, excuse me for doing this, but I have grown nearly blind in your service. And with that, the conspiracy among the officers just melted away in an instant, like snow under a bright sun. And Washington, through those theatrics, had accomplished what he had set out to accomplish and what his speech failed to achieve.
Right. And I think in the accounts of that meeting, there are stories that some of the disgruntled officers who were leaning toward insurrection started crying.
That's
as he pulled
right.
out the glasses and read it.
Openly, I think probably felt some guilt at what they had done, and the fact that Washington, above all else, I think, achieved this sense with his officers and with the public too, that he was sacrificing during the war, and he was sacrificing. I mean, he left home. He leaves to go to Congress, which appoints him to be commander of the army in May of 1775, and he doesn't get back to Mount Vernon until the fall of 1781. So he's away all of that time. He doesn't take any pay. He says at the very beginning, when he accepts his appointment as commander, I'll serve without pay. I only ask that you pay my expenses during the war. So he did live in a sacrificial manner, and that was what at least at the beginning of the war that was so the ethic that prevailed, what we oftentimes call the spirit of 1776, that people had to sacrifice in order for this revolution to succeed and for the war to be won. And Washington, more than anybody, I think, acted in a sacrificial manner throughout the war and won the hearts of his countrymen and his officers by doing so.
Well, when we talk about, you know, his use of symbolism and gesture, another thing that he was a master of is, I think it was Adams who said that he had the gift of silence. Yeah, I mean, his second inaugural was the shortest ever.
Adams wished that he had. Adams talked too much, I think. But you know, Washington did have that gift of silence. In fact, oftentimes I think today, I don't know when it started, maybe with, I think probably President Reagan may have been the one that started it, but for the last 30 or 40 years, it seems that presidents almost daily are on television making a statement about this or that, and oftentimes they wind up inserting their foot in their mouth because of something they say spontaneously. And Washington was wise enough not to do that. He was very, very quiet and thoughtful, and only spoke when after he had really thought things through.
Yeah, and I think that's lost on a lot of politicians today. I remember people criticizing Clinton because political gurus thought that he had way too many press conferences. And I remember there was, you probably know this story, it was about 4 months into Washington's presidency, and I believe it was a senator from Pennsylvania was invited to dinner, and he noted that Washington toasted everyone at the table, and then the dinner began. And he just sat there. Everyone talked, and he just sat there, kind of drumming his fork on the table. And so then the guy figured, okay, well, you know, once the women leave the table, then the real discussion will begin. So then the women left the table after dinner, and they're sitting there having their aperitifs and cigars or whatever. And he still just sits there completely silent while everyone speaks. And there is, I think, some wisdom. You know, I guess everyone was waiting 4 months in to know who he was going to appoint, what he was going to do, what decisions he was going to make. And he was smart enough not to put it out there and hold back.
That's right. And in fact, when he became president, he wrote to three or four people, to Vice President John Adams, to Alexander Hamilton, and a couple of others, and he asked their advice on how he should comport himself as president. And I think probably followed the advice of Hamilton more than anyone else. But Hamilton laid out, in essence, sort of almost like a monarchical behavior for Washington, that he was to be remote. He would have levees, that is, he would open the door to the president's house once a month or so, or once a week, and people would come in, and he would greet them, and that he would have formal dinners, but that he would not go to anyone else's house. And if somebody asked him over for dinner, he would refuse, and that was the behavior. It was a sort of a very Olympian kind of detachment, almost like a European monarch, and I think it fit his character and his temperament very well, because he was sort of an aloof individual. I always felt that, as you mentioned, Washington was not formally educated, and I think he always was quite self-conscious about that. I mean, he was surrounded by people, almost everybody that he was surrounded by, even during the war, was a college graduate. And he had very little formal education, and I think it led to something of a sense of inferiority on his part, and he tried to cover it up by keeping people at arm's length so they wouldn't discover what he regarded as things that he might be inferior in. And so he did have this kind of detached manner about him, and that was certainly the way he operated as president.
Wow. So the famous Washington aloofness was actually his way of masking his own insecurities. Who knew? Well, we're going to wrap up part one here and pick up in the next episode. And thank you again, John, for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with John Ferling today. And if you did, then I think you'd love his fascinating book, The Ascent of George Washington, The Hidden Political Genius of an American Icon, by my guest today, author and historian John Ferling. And right now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion for our listeners from audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The Ascent of George Washington by my guest today, John Ferling, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, iPad, or MP3 player. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click the sponsor link on our webpage for your free audiobook download. I hope you'll subscribe to the podcast on iTunes so you can automatically get new episodes as they become available. And if you have a minute, then leave us a review on iTunes. Both of those things help a lot with our iTunes rankings and our advertisers. And if you really want to help out and keep us strong, then please support the show by making a donation to our GoFundMe campaign at gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or go to the show website and click on the donate link. Producing a show like this isn't cheap, folks. We've got studio rental, equipment, sound engineer, etc., and your support will help cover some of those costs and hopefully even allow us to produce more new episodes per week. So help us out. That's gofundme.com/kickasspolitics. Or you can go to kickasspolitics.com and click on the donate link. As always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com or leave a voicemail on the toll-free listener hotline at 844-KA-POLITICS. Now, this was only part one of The Political Genius of George Washington, so be sure to tune into the next episode when we'll delve even further into the side of George Washington that few people ever really knew with author and historian John Ferling. Until then, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. This podcast may not be reproduced without express written permission. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.